Greetings once again, America. You may have heard the news, but stand by now for the Worldview. That's right, it's the weekly Worldview coming at you this week. From the subterranean studios right here at theweeklyworldview.com. It's so good to have everyone aboard as we join our regularly scheduled broadcast in progress. Good to have you here. Now, I want to open up. Well, I got to open up with my open. Yeah, my open. This is the Worldview. It's the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do take the news of the week and focus it through the lens of original thought. And we're going to begin this week with an interesting announcement from Wake Forest University out in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Former President Jimmy Carter and poet Maya Angelou will speak later this month at a meeting of Southeastern Baptist organizations at Wake Forest University. Maya Angelou, apparently, according to the Associated Press, is a professor at Wake Forest University. So this is just a warning to all of you parents who may have been thinking about sending your daughters to college. Maya Angelou is a professor at Wake Forest University. That's right. Now, Jimmy Carter, who is he? Well, he's just a decrepit old phony baloney egomaniacal anti-Semitic buffoon. A completely hollow, empty failure of a man. by the way, who was elected by a majority of the American people over 30 years ago. So those of us who lament the current state of affairs here in America and long for the good old days, so to speak, well, the good old days has to be at least 30 years ago, has to be longer, farther back than 30 years ago, because 30 years ago we elected Jimmy Carter, for crying out loud. Yeah, a majority. For those of you who worship democracy and think democracy is the be-all and end-all and just the cat's meow, well, a majority of the American people elected Jimmy Carter 30-some-odd years ago. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's popularly held that his 2% victory in the popular vote came from black folks and poor folks who thought that he could help them. And so we've come full circle. And why would I open with a relatively innocuous and meaningless story about Jimmy Carter and some professor, Maya Angelou, poet laureate, allegedly, speaking at Wake Forest? It's because this entire week I've been thinking I was reliving Jimmy Carter's last days as the president. If you'll remember, back in 1980, in the days leading up to the election of Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter was dealing with the hostage crisis over there in Iran, and he was just paralyzed and didn't know what to do and couldn't move. And it tried a rescue attempt, and the military, they were all, you know, a bunch of potheads in those days. They crashed their helicopters into each other. It was just awful. And I don't know that any of those people on those helicopters were potheads. I don't want to say that, but let's just say that the military wasn't all it could have been and should have been at that point, and that the ranks were swelled with potheads and druggies and just basically ineffectual morons all throughout the rank and file of the military back then. And Jimmy Carter, right at the very top, the most inept and bungling of them all. So we've been following the pirate story, of course. Oh, wait, before we get to the pirate story in the last days of Jimmy Carter, since I mentioned Maya Angelou, did you guys see the press release from Philip Morris USA? Yeah. Here it is. I saw this on Philip Morris's website. On February 4th, 2009, the federal government enacted legislation to fund the expansion of the State Children's Health Insurance Program, SCHIP, that increased excise taxes on cigarettes by 158%. As a result, you will see the price of all cigarettes, including ours, increase in price at retail stores. So, The prices on cigarettes are going up. Why do I mention that? Well, because whenever I mention Maya Angelou, it always reminds me of someone who just smoked a carton of Marlboro cigarettes. And so, you know, today I'm boycotting tobacco for today. And maybe further, I don't know. But because the price of cigarettes here in Colorado is $6 and approaching $7 a pack in various outlets, today is a boycott for me. Resurrection Sunday, I'm boycotting tobacco. But Philip Morris doesn't have to worry because Maya Angelou's still around. She sounds like she smokes about a carton a day. All right, now let's move on to the pirate story, which I had mentioned to my wife earlier in the week that Barack Obama is this week facing his Jimmy Carter moment. And if he's completely paralyzed and he's unable to do the right thing in exercising military force with precision to rescue this captain, this hostage there at sea, that while it would be bad for us, bad for our country, at least we would know that Barack Obama, and bad particularly for the hostage and the folks out there seafaring there, off the Horn of Africa, it would be bad for Barack Obama to be paralyzed and unable to do the right thing. But at least we would know that Barack Obama, as dangerous as he seems, is just another inept, paralyzed, bumbling idiot like Jimmy Carter. And while he will do some damage, we shall survive him. Well, it ended well for the hostage, because Barack Obama did dispatch the U.S. Navy SEALs, who with precision and the bravery of this captain, he jumps off the boat. The Navy SEALs apparently fill the boat full of lead, butcher, slaughter three of the pirates, and take into custody one of them that was negotiating on board the U.S. Navy ship. So with military precision, the Navy SEALs execute what appears to be a brilliant mission, rescuing the captain and ending the standoff and ending Barack Obama's Jimmy Carter moment. So what has Barack Obama proved to us, who we playfully refer to here as Barry Ho, President of the United States? What has he proven to us? Well, we know that he is at least as dangerous as was Jimmy Carter to the future of our nation. And now he's proven to us that he actually has the guts to get stuff done, which is doubly scary for myself and anyone who values freedom and liberty and the American ideal, the free market. Not only do we have a Jimmy Carter-style socialist, but we've got one with some stones who can get it done. And that is scary for me. Now, I was very interested. I'd been following this pirate story all week, and I read this story that I'll just read it to you from the Associated Press earlier in the week. Attorney General Eric Holder said this past week that the Justice Department, that the Federal Bureau of Investigation planned to interview the crew of the U.S. cargo ship that the pirates had taken over and begin building a criminal case against the pirates. And I thought to myself, truly, this is a Jimmy Carter moment. Attorney General Eric Holder said that the Justice Department had not seen a case of piracy against a U.S. ship in a very long time, but authorities have prepared for such an event as the threat of piracy, since especially along the African coast, as incidents of piracy have risen. Stephen Mull, the acting Undersecretary of State for International Security and Arms Control, told Congress last month, quote, "If there were ever a U.S. victim of one of these attacks or a U.S. shipping line that were a victim, our Justice Department has said that it would favorably consider prosecuting such apprehended pirates." Prosecuting pirates? What are you talking about? You don't prosecute pirates. I think the last time we had incidents of piracy was in the late 1700s, early 1800s, off the Barbary Coast of Africa, and the U.S. Marines were dispatched, and not only did they swashbuckle aboard the ships and butcher these Muslim extremist terrorists, they also landed in Tripoli and killed their protectors and their benefactors there on land. That's right. So we've got to hope that the United States military not only dispatches any future pirates, any aspiring pirates, all you young pirates in Somalia out there, take note, that you will be dispatched to Allah very rapidly by the Navy SEALs. But what we need to do is we need to land in Hadrare or Hadriri or Mogadishu or wherever these guys' sponsors are. Because these pirates are, what are they doing with the tens of millions of dollars that they're bilking out of these companies? I can assure you that these pirates are being controlled by some government. They're being funded, they're being aided, they're being trained by some government or corporate interests, perhaps. But that needs to be located on land and it needs to be dealt with. All right. So that's enough with the pirates. Now, just in case that pirate story gave you some warm, fuzzy feeling about the U.S. military, and you thought that our military is still cutting edge and can still defend Western civilization against the forces arrayed against us, well, don't get your hopes up, okay? A story in the Associated Press this week reported on the first association representing gay and lesbian alumni of West Point. Yes, you heard me right. Just when you thought it was safe to go back into the military, West Point is, well, the queers at West Point are rearing their ugly heads, so to speak. Already, this group known as Knights Out, that's Knights Out, K-N-I-G-H-T, Knights Out, it already has 50 members who have publicly identified themselves as fags on the group's website. Knights Out's stated mission is to advocate for a repeal of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy so that gays, and that doesn't mean happy people, that means homosexual people, can serve openly in the military and help. And the group also wants to help prepare the West Point community to be effective leaders after that policy change occurs. Yeah. And by the way, right now, Knights Out has no formal relationship with the Academy or West Point Association of Graduates, which is the main alumni association. But they are preparing initiatives that can be employed only when Don't Ask, Don't Tell is repealed. For example, they want to help form a gay-straight alliance at West Point. Did you hear me? I said a gay-straight alliance at West Point, for crying out loud. I might rather go serve with the pirates. Speaking of pirates, well, we'll just leave that aside. Let's see. Sue Fulton is Knights Out's communications director, and she's a 50-year-old unattractive bull dyke who graduated from West Point in 1980 as part of the first class that included women. And see, I tell you right there, as soon as West Point started admitting women, it was a matter of time before feminists and bull dykes and the like began to insinuate themselves into the fine history of that great military academy. And now look what we've got. We've got a bunch of queer Gay Point graduates coming out of the closet, announcing themselves as fags, and now they want to hook up with the official alumni association, so to speak. So, oh, by the way, just in case you're associated with other branches of the military, gay lesbian alumni from the Naval Academy formed an association in 2003 called USNA Out. And a comparable Air Force Academy alumni group, Blue Alliance, was formed in 2007. So 2003, the Navy alumni come out as fags. 2007, the Air Force. 2008, now we've got a West Point homosexual alumni pile. And what is it? Is the 21st century the queer century? I mean, they've been pouring out of the closet since the 90s, but I mean, ever since the 21st century began, they have really started to pour out of the closet. And I'm thankful that the Marine Corps has no formal academy, or I'm certain that we would have some kind of fag homo Marine Alumni Association trying to get Marines to publicly identify themselves as homosexual. Anyway, it's just disturbing. So just in case you were lulled by the pirate story into thinking that our military is still strong, beware. So if you were thinking about sending your kids to college, you want to beware there. If you're thinking about allowing your kids to join the military, you want to be careful there. But apparently, at least the Navy SEALs, at least they're not coming out of the closet. Right, it's the Weekly Worldview. Where did that come from? I haven't heard that. All right, that's very good. It's the Weekly Worldview. I'm your humble host, Doug McBurney, and we've done away with the pirates, whether in the military or on board ship or wherever the pirates are these days. We've moved on from that story, thankfully. Now we're going to talk about Barry Ho, and having avoided his Jimmy Carter moment this week, we can cover him like a real man. At least we know he's a real man, okay? He may be a communist, a socialist, a Marxist, a child killer, but at least he hasn't sunk to the level of Jimmy Carter. This week from the Washington Post, we learned that senior Obama administration officials are debating how to address a potential terrorist threat to U.S. interests from a Somali extremist group, with some in the military advocating strikes against its training camps, but many officials maintain that uncertainty about the intentions of the Al-Shabaab organization, that's right, the Al-Shabaab organization, dictates a more patient, non-military approach. So you can bet that the folks who are uncertain about what Al-Shabaab is up to, they're in the State Department, they're over there smoking dope and taking Xanax and chewing on oxycodone pills all day. Meanwhile, there's people in the military who are saying, look, Al-Shabaab is a radical Muslim group operating and training terrorists inside Somalia. We need to go in there and flatten them. But the State Department tends to win the day in most cases, whether we've got a Republican or a Democrat in the White House. It just doesn't matter. Now, Al-Shabaab, who, one thing you've got to, you know, Al-Shabaab is like the B or the C team in the Islamic terrorist hierarchy. Number one, Al-Qaeda definitely got the cooler name. You know, these guys, Al-Shabaab, this is obviously the B or the C team, the third stringers, because all the first stringers, obviously, were killed in the September 11th attack. But since the Western military complexes, and I'm talking about Western Europe and the United States, have decided to tolerate the existence of groups like Al-Shabaab and other terrorist organizations in Afghanistan and Pakistan, they are rapidly training a new first-string team, and it's just a matter of time before they execute some other terrorist attack. How much of a threat they are, I don't know. They're definitely not as much of a threat as the disciples of the likes of Jimmy Carter and Barry Ho are, but they are something of a threat, and they need to be dealt with. This article from the Washington Post closes with an interesting line. The most recent discussions of this issue regarding Al-Shabaab, the Somali terrorist group, took place earlier this week just before the unrelated seizure of a U.S. commercial ship in the Indian Ocean by Somali pirates. So the Washington Post tells us that these pirates are unrelated to the Muslim terrorists on the mainland. And so we can be assured that that's true because it came to us from the Washington Post. Anyway, I think we should flatten Hadrari and flatten parts of Mogadishu and let these pirates know that if you're going to operate as pirates, we're going to destroy your base of operations. That's the way you deal with pirates. That's war. Piracy is an act of war, and war is an ugly and brutal and unpleasant thing. And unfortunately, when terrorists force a country like the United States or France or Germany or India or China or whoever they're committing acts of piracy against, when terrorists force governments into positions where they must defend themselves in a situation of war, that means that massive amounts of civilians are going to be killed, because that's what war entails. When it gets to that point, ladies and gentlemen, the bad guys have forced us to that point, and it's time to go on land there. Send in the Marines. I'm sure they could. Well, actually, I don't know if they could handle it, to be honest with you. I mean, they're in Iraq, they're in Afghanistan, but I know there's bunches of them laying around in Japan and Korea and Okinawa, soaking up the sun, drinking beer. Send those guys. Anyways. All right. Now, this is from the Chocolate Caesar file, which I don't know why. That's my new Barry Ho euphemism. He's the Chocolate Caesar. I've been following the story all week about where the Obamas plan to spend Easter Sunday, and I don't know why I found that fascinating, but I did. And I'll just pull down some snippets that I followed during the week. Obama's presidential campaign actively sought support from the evangelicals. You remember that. The AP tells us that evangelicals are traditionally a bloc that support Republicans, but Barry Ho, the Chocolate Caesar, carved out a share of that group as part of his winning coalition in the 2008 election. During the hard-fought campaign, Obama often spoke of his own faith and fought back rumors that he was a secret Muslim. Since the new year, by the way, this is from another story from the Reuters Wire, since the new year, the Obamas have attended church twice in Washington. 2 days before the inauguration, they were in a three-hour sermon, and it doesn't even go into the next one because, hey, you know, whatever. He's been there. He's been to church twice. Now, White House aides, according to another Washington Post article, noted that the Obamas have spent several weekends at the presidential retreat at Camp David, where there is a chapel, and aides say there would be no way to know if the Obamas visited the chapel for private prayer with a guest pastor. Well, let me just take a wild guess at this and say that they didn't go into the chapel, that they didn't pray, and that they didn't have a guest pastor, Muslim or otherwise, because they're just run-of-the-mill pagans or atheists or what do you call them, agnostics or something. They're humanists, for crying out loud. They're not religious people, the Obamas. But they did go to church this Sunday. I followed this up after I went to church myself this morning. Dateline, Washington, D.C., President Barack Obama and his family took communion Sunday as they celebrated Easter at St. John's Church in their first public worship service since the inauguration. In his sermon, the Reverend Louis Leon welcomed believers and non-believers alike and called Easter an event based on faith, not on logic. So the Reverend Louis Leon welcomed believers and non-believers alike. So the Obamas felt right at home. They felt welcome anyway. And what did the Right Reverend Louis Leon have to say from the pulpit? He said, "I can't explain Easter to anyone. It just can't be done. It's like a professor trying to explain one of E.E. Cummings' poems." And I thought to myself, you're a minister of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and you say that you can't explain Easter to anyone? Maybe you should look into another line of work, you know? I'll bet you can explain Das Kapital to someone. Unbelievable. So anyway, the Obamas went to church with a bunch of other heathens. Oh, and here we go. Again from the Chocolate Caesar file. The apparently Michelle Obama has found the need for a full-time makeup artist. Yeah, a full-time makeup artist. According to the New York Post, Michelle Obama is the nation's first lady to add a full-time makeup artist to her traveling entourage of various deviants and homosexuals and feminists. According to stylists who have worked with presidential wives last year, they're reporting that she has a full-time makeup artist named Ingrid Grimes-Miles. Grimes-Miles, who's 49 years old. And I got to say, Ingrid, good luck with that one. I hope you bring a shovel, okay? And that's all I'm going to say on that. Now, the first puppy has made a big splash, according to an article from the Associated Press. We've all been following this story with bated breath and on the edges of our seats all week. Apparently, the Obamas have decided, you remember what they said, that they were going to adopt a dog from a puppy shelter. They were going to go down and find some flea bag, tick-infested, poor sad sack dog, and they were going to adopt him into the White House. That's the way I remember the story developing some months ago. Well, they have adopted a dog, apparently, and it's big news. They've adopted a six-month-old Portuguese water dog. Yep, and he was given to the Obama girls as a gift by guess who? Senator Edward M. Kennedy of Massachusetts. Does anyone else find it ironic that he chose to give them a water dog? I mean, am I the only person who finds that a bit ironic? Now, the Obamas, according to this article from the AP Wire today, the Obamas have long said they wanted a rescue dog, but the carefully bred... I find that a little ironic in the reportage here. A rescue dog. Now, that doesn't mean a dog who, let's say, would rescue someone if they were in a car that had landed upside down in the water. That means a dog that is rescued from being euthanized at the ASPCA or whatever. A dog shelter. Okay. That's what that means. Oh, okay. Not a dog that would rescue a young lady who was being left to die by a United States senator. No, that's a different type of dog. Anyway, but to move on, the Obamas had said they wanted to adopt a dog, a sad sack, flea bag, tick-infested loser dog, so that they could impress their liberal friends. But anyways, apparently, Portuguese water dogs almost never end up in shelters because they're purebreds and they cost thousands of dollars. So the dog, who, by the way, ironically, the Obama girls have named B.O. Yeah, B.O. Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry. That's Bo.
Oh,
Bo. I thought it was B.O. like their dad. Anyway, Barack Obama. Anyway, they named the dog Bo. And a Bo had been living, according to this article, with another family, but it wasn't a good fit. So the Kennedys acquired him for the Obamas. So the Kennedys apparently decided that this dog's fate was better left in the hands of Barry Ho, the Chocolate Caesar, and his family, rather than this other loser family who couldn't handle the dog. Anyway, someone needs to go check on that family, make sure they're okay, make sure none of them were drowned so that Teddy could give this dog to the Obamas. As for the rescue pledge, the Obamas came up with a solution intended to lend a serious symbolic note. They're going to make a donation to the D.C. Humane Society. Rather than actually take in a flea bag, tick-infested, loser, sad sack, sick dog that they actually had to help and nurse back to health, they're just going to take a purebred worth several thousand dollars and just throw some money at it. That's a perfectly liberal solution. You don't have to actually do good. All you have to do is act good and look good and throw money at things. Preferably other people's money. We'll follow that story. No, we won't. We won't follow that story at all. But now, have you heard of this? Now, talking about dogs, Honda has unveiled a dog-friendly car. Yeah. According to Reuters, Dateline New York, Americans will soon be able to buy a pet-friendly car with a cushioned dog bed in the trunk, fitted with a built-in water bowl, and a fan and a ramp to help less agile dogs climb in. Japanese automaker Honda unveiled the pet-friendly version of its Element utility vehicle at the New York Auto Show. It features easy-wash seat covers, a fitted dog bed with restraints in case there's an accident, and a paw logo on the side. Honda said the car would go on sale across the United States from the fall of this year. Now, have I ever told the audience my theory on dogs? Probably not. So if there's anyone in the audience who hasn't been offended or alienated by something I've said yet, now is your moment, because you are not going to like this. But I'm going to say it, okay? Here's my theory on dogs, and I have owned a few dogs, and I can honestly say that it wasn't that pleasant of an experience overall. Here's my theory on dogs, and it relates to my theory on cavemen. Why is there evidence that there are cavemen that would make an evolutionist believe that we evolved from some lower, less intelligent life form? I believe that that is because throughout history, there have been points in history where societies and cultures have fallen apart and basically descended to the level of the caveman, where people were basically living outside in the caves, in the rocks, hiding from each other, throwing rocks at each other, eating whatever crawled by, killing and eating each other at times, and that at some point when that occurred, men began to domesticate dogs to protect themselves from other human beings who had just descended to the level of brutal, inhumane, vicious killers and marauders. Pirates, one might say. So, and that's how dogs became domesticated. It was basically a desperate measure by desperate, uncivilized people to protect themselves. And let's face it, at least for the moment, here in America, you don't really need a dog in the suburbs. Now, out on the farm, I suppose you can have a dog, I suppose. I don't know if I would. But I suppose you can have a dog out on the farm. But to me, domesticating a dog, especially in the suburbs, number one, it's really stinky, it's dirty, it's foul. And to me, it's just uncivilized. Worldview, and I'm Doug McBurney. Glad to have you with us, and we're running out of time, and we've still got a lot of stuff to get to. Now, in case you were thinking about sending your daughter to college, or your son for that matter, let's look into what's happening out at Notre Dame, a once traditionally, I don't know if it was a Christian school, it was certainly a Catholic school. Barack Obama, apparently the chocolate Caesar, Barry Ho, has been invited to speak out there, and there's some controversy I've got an article from the Minneapolis Star Tribune, and they quote a visiting high school senior, a girl who said she was thrilled just weeks ago to be accepted for admission into Notre Dame, but said she might reject the offer because the university is hosting the most pro-abortion president we've ever had. And that's a quote from this high school senior, that Barry Ho is, quote, the most pro-abortion president we've ever had. And she's absolutely right on that. So I suppose you can graduate from public high school knowing something. Shocking. Well, they don't say that they just say she's a high school senior. And she seems somehow to have gained some knowledge, which is frankly amazing. But she's very upset, as are many conservatives associated with Notre Dame. But the majority of the students at Notre Dame are more like this. This is Brett Ensor, a Texas native who belongs to the Knights of Columbus, opposes abortion, voted for the Republicans in the last election. And he says, quote, oh, most of us are like, wow, President of the United States is coming. Dang. What college wouldn't want Obama to come? This is President of the United States. This is a tremendous honor for us. Unquote. That's a conservative student at a conservative university, Notre Dame. Yeah. And then they quote another liberal in here, too. Who is this? Let's see here. A liberal, who cares what their name is? This liberal, pro-choice, scumbag, fag-lover student said, if you can't speak openly at Notre Dame, who's going to want to come here? President Obama is one of us. He's on our side. So that's the liberal student out at Notre Dame. So even the conservatives and the liberals out at Notre Dame are both just gaga over the chocolate Caesar coming to grace their formerly... I don't know if they're formerly anything, frankly. Notre Dame might have formerly been something. I think they had a good football team at one point, but I certainly wouldn't send any of my kids to college there. Okay, now on to Boulder, Colorado, from the prestigious Colorado University. The University of Colorado plans to challenge reinstatement efforts by 61-year-old Ward Churchill. Yes, he's trying to get his job back now that he handily defeated the college. You guys, I don't know if you guys followed the trial. It was big, big news here in Denver. The former University of Colorado Boulder professor was fired on charges of research misconduct. In his trial, he said he was dismissed in retaliation for writing an essay that compared some September 11th victims to Nazis. And the jury here in Denver, we followed the trial, and they agreed that these charges of research misconduct, they were pretty much trumped up by the university, because the folks at the university didn't have the nerve to fire Ward Churchill for being an anti-American dirtbag. They couldn't just come out and say, look, you're anti-American. We've got audio tape of you inciting students to actually commit acts of violence against the government. You're fired. In fact, he probably should have been arrested, for crying out loud. But here in America today, especially in the university environment, free speech is sacred. There's only two things sacred in the university environment. And that is sodomy and freedom to speak about anything you want, especially if it's un-American. Those two things are sacred. Those are the only two sacred things in the university environment. But anyway, I'm happy to see that the phony baloney Republican morons at the University of Colorado Regents Chess Club or whatever they are out there, I'm glad to see that Ward Churchill beat them. Now, he is going to get his job back. Not only is he going to get his job back, he is going to be virtually untouchable at the University of Colorado. He's going to be able to burn down the student union and set the American flag on fire anytime he wants, and he'll never be fired. So if you were thinking about sending your kid to the University in Colorado, first of all, what were you thinking about to even think about that? But now, I mean, Ward Churchill is going to be the... Well, I think it's good. It's good because he will be the figurehead of the University of Colorado, and anyone with half an ounce of sense will at least not send their kid to the University of Colorado, and I suppose that's a good thing. I mean, that's about as good as we can get anymore. Anyway, okay, let's move on to the domestic tranquility file, and I'll try to go through it quickly, but as usual, the domestic tranquility file, which basically catalogs the destruction of peace and domestic tranquility and the ability for us to be secure in our homes and comfortable and relaxed. Basically, it documents the failure of the government, state, local, and federal, to protect us against the crime epidemic. That's what the domestic tranquility file is about. Dateline, Philadelphia, from the Associated Press. A teenager awaiting trial in the death of a Starbucks manager on a downtown subway concourse is on house arrest, but police say he has managed to commit yet another crime. Young Kenta Stanton, a 17-year-old punk dirtbag, was playing with a gun in the basement of his North Philadelphia house last Wednesday when the weapon discharged somehow. The blast struck a 17-year-old friend in the torso, critically injuring him. So Stanton was charged Thursday as an adult with assault, reckless endangerment, and multiple weapons counts. Now, this young punk, if you'll remember, was one of five teens charged in March of last year in the death of Sean Patrick Conroy. He's charged as a juvenile with third-degree murder in that case, with his trial scheduled to begin next week. This Starbucks owner, if you'll remember, Conroy, he was chosen at random by these five teens, one of them being Kenta Stanton, and beaten in the underground concourse near the Starbucks he managed. He was found on his knees by police, gasping for air. And the police actually watched the attack from across the tracks and just couldn't get there in time. And this Starbucks manager died a short time later, having been beaten to death by young Kenta Stanton and a number of his friends. And now this guy shot someone else in his basement. Because why? Because we've tolerated the little bastard. We've allowed him to live, and so he's gone and shot someone else, waiting for his trial. His trial should have been over. He should be 6 feet in the ground. And this other kid who just got shot in his basement, well, he wouldn't have got shot. Defense lawyer Lonnie Fish said it was still unclear what really happened in Kenta Stanton's basement in this latest incident because the victim's story has changed several times. So we don't really know what happened, but we know what could have happened if young Kenta had been put where he belonged, which was in front of a firing squad or something similar, within, I don't know, 30 days of the murder of the Starbucks manager. This whole thing could have been avoided. I could be moving on to another story, and the domestic tranquility file might not be so thick. Dateline Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. A senior at Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania is facing criminal homicide charges after his former girlfriend was found dead in his off-campus apartment. She had been choked and stabbed. Police this past Thursday arrested 21-year-old Kevin Robert Schaefer in the slaying of 19-year-old Emily Rachel Silverstein. Authorities say the two had a romantic relationship that had ended. Police are not commenting about a potential motive. Well, the potential motive is right there. They had a romantic relationship that had ended. And it seems like these days, among the younger set, that when a romantic relationship comes to an end, it often ends in gunplay, which is about where we would figure we would be after this long, tolerating this much sexual immorality and allowing our young people to become so overcharged with sexual immorality that when it blows up in their faces, they have a tendency to kill each other and themselves. And it's really not that surprising. And it happens an awful lot. Dateline Tarrytown, Louisiana. An 11-year-old girl was in stable condition Saturday. The girl had been shot more than once. Let's see, Dominique Sterling, 19, was shot in the back. Her 23-month-old son, Robert, and a 6-year-old boy were shot in the head while they were in bed. All three of those were murdered. And we have an 11-year-old girl, last we heard, in stable condition. Investigators found marijuana and crack cocaine in their apartment. That's Tarrytown, Louisiana. Dateline West Babylon, New York, a retired New York City police officer shot an off-duty officer he suspected was having an affair with his police officer wife, then killed himself in the driveway of his suburban home. West Babylon, indeed. West Babylon, New York, from the domestic tranquility file. Dateline Dearborn, Michigan, a student fatally shot a female classmate before turning the gun on himself Friday in an apparent murder-suicide. The bodies of Asia McGowan and Anthony Powell were discovered inside a classroom at a Henry Ford Community College building. Powell apparently used a shotgun to kill McGowan and himself. This shooting happened in Dearborn, Michigan on Good Friday. And in a related article, Dateline Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, from the Associated Press, Independence Hall Tower in Philadelphia is leaking, and it needs to be repaired. Park officials say options range from minor repairs to complete rehabilitation. The tower sustained damage, apparently, because the roof had been leaking. And this rusted the infrastructure, the iron infrastructure that ran through the wood siding. And the only reason I bring this article up is because I think this is an apt analogy. And quite ironic that this story hit the wires this week and made it here to the Weekly Worldview in the midst of the, or to close out the domestic tranquility file, because Independence Hall, there in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, represents to me the infrastructure of America. Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. I mean, that's very apt that at this point in our history, that Independence Hall is in need of serious repair. And I don't think that minor repairs are going to get it done. No. I don't think minor repairs are going to get it done. I think what we need here is major rehabilitation. It's the Weekly World View, and I am your host, Doug McBurney, coming to you high atop, well, the country, frankly. We're a mile high here, approximately, here in Denver, Colorado, and we're glad to have you with us here at the Weekly World View from the subterranean studios, where we think we're safe, at least from natural disasters. And so back to the dog thing, okay? We're here in the suburbs. And so all you need is good lighting outside of your house and a pistol or a shotgun, okay? And then you don't need a dog. And for those of you who find dogs to be just wonderful companions and lovable characters and even members of your family, well, that's all well and good, and that's wonderful. I'm just telling you why it is that at some point in our history, we decided to take this filthy, mangy, disease-infested beast and invite him to live with us. It just, I mean, think about it, folks. It just doesn't make... I mean, now we've cleaned them up. Don't get me wrong. I'm sure that your dog is very clean and, you know, not so disease-infested, not a threat to your children or anything like that. But, I mean, if we go back into history... And we look at, and you think about what a dog must have looked like at, you know, a few thousand years ago, when the mangy little critters were just... All right, let's just move on. I'm sure I've alienated an awful lot of people with that, and I don't know why I went back to that. I think it was because I'm trying to avoid this covering the International Follies file, because it's just so depressing to see what's going on around the world. As the United States... and Western civilization in general continues its inexorable decline into socialism, for one, economically, into utter corruption financially, into outright murder, morally, murder. All the Western governments now tolerate and celebrate murder as a right protected by law. The right to murder innocent people is a right protected by law in the Western world. So that, and we've descended rather rapidly. It's as if it all began at the beginning of my life. But I know it goes back much further than that. Don't get me wrong. I know, but it seems to have accelerated in my short lifetime. Is there anything I missed there in the descent? Oh, yes, that's right. The celebration and the tolerance for sexual immorality. And by that, I mean divorce. I mean adultery. And yes, I will include with that homosexuality. The tolerance and even the celebration of those three things mark the decline of Western civilization. And then when you look at the news of the week, well, it's just depressing to see the fruit of that decline and that decay rear its ugly head every day in the way we respond and react to crises, to threats, and to opportunities to teach the rest of the world. That's right. There are not only crises and threats that our government must respond to and manage, there are also opportunities to teach that we are squandering. Or we are teaching the wrong thing to the rest of the world. Dateline, do I want to do this first? This is really depressing. All right. Dateline, North Korea. From the London Times, the first credible pictures of Kim Dong-il, taken in at least 8 months, emerged this past week as he was unanimously reelected Supreme Leader of North Korea. The military dictator, who has not been seen in public since he suffered a suspected stroke in August of 2008, was welcomed to the Supreme People's Assembly with a standing ovation by the parliamentary deputies. That's right. A standing ovation for Kim Dong-il. Yeah. It was eerily reminiscent of the standing ovation that John McCain received at the CPAC convention last month. Did you guys see that? I mean, here's the guy responsible for taking his followers right to the edge of utter destruction, and he receives a standing ovation. Now, I'm not talking about Kim Dong-il. I'm talking about John McCain. Anyway, it was eerily reminiscent, very bizarre to go to see. And by the way, a little further down in the story from the London Times, on a visit to China, the defeated U.S. presidential candidate, John McCain, pressed North Korea's likely ally, I mean, North Korea's key ally, China, to join a U.N. censure motion on its communist neighbor, all related back to North Korea's launching of the missile, you remember. But anyway, we're not talking about that yet. We're talking about Kim Dong-il's standing ovation and his glorious appearance at Parliament there in North Korea. Analysts said that the carefully choreographed session of the Supreme People's Assembly would give Kim a mandate that cemented his legacy of building a military-first state and could lead to a transfer of power to one of his three sons. You know, that's the first I've been aware that Kim Dong-il had three sons. That's fairly disturbing to learn that. And now, what has happened now that North Korea has launched their missile and no one had the nerve to shoot it down? Well, over at the United Nations, they're quite upset. The Security Council stalemate over North Korea's rocket launch turned into an early test of the Obama administration's UN-focused multilateralism. According to an article from the Reuters Wire, 6 days after President Barryho, the chocolate Caesar, called for swift punishment of North Korea, the Security Council still hadn't acted. Japan was pressing for a quick response, but U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Susan Rice, has tried to downplay expectations of any immediate progress. China and Russia have resisted a draft Security Council resolution put forth by the U.S. and Japan that would, at a minimum, enforce military and financial sanctions imposed on North Korea after its underground nuclear weapons test in October 2006. So the United Nations has been relatively paralyzed over the past week, again leading me to look at this entire week as Barry Ho's Jimmy Carter moment. Could he get past it? Because not only were the pirates jerking him around out there in the Indian Ocean, but we had the North Koreans yanking his chain and laughing at him, and the UN just perplexed and paralyzed and unable to do anything. Well, fear not, UN powers have condemned North Korea's rocket launch. That's right. Key Security Council nations reached agreement Saturday on a statement that would condemn North Korea's rocket launch and ostensibly toughen UN sanctions against the reclusive communist nation. Yes, the United Nations has released a statement. Yes, they've issued what they call a presidential statement. What does that mean? Who knows what that means? It's basically, you know, it's a statement. It gives their opinion that Dong and North Korea are not working and playing well with others. But when the time comes for any real action, ladies and gentlemen, or any detention or timeout or whatever the Security Council decides that they're going to impose on the North Koreans, you know what you're going to hear from China and Russia, right? When the time comes for real action, what are you going to hear from China and Russia? No soup for you! That's what you're going to hear. No soup for you! No sanctions for you! No economic sanctions for you.
No shoes for you.
No shoes for you. No food for you. No, the Russians and the Chinese are not going to back the UN or any of the other student council up there or the crossing guards out there at the United Nations. They're not going to back them up on any significant military action. It's ridiculous. And because the West has lost any moral superiority to the Mongol hordes, you know, or the mad Russians, there's really not much we can do. And it's depressing, but there it is. All right, more from the International Follies file. Dateline Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, from the Reuters Wire. A Saudi man has divorced his wife by text messaging, according to a newspaper. The man was in Iraq when he sent the text informing her that she was no longer his spouse. That's right. A court in the Red Sea city of Jeddah has finalized the divorce, the first known divorce in Saudi Arabia by text message. Yeah, now you'll remember, Saudi Arabia, who's our ally, keep this in mind, they are our modern-day ally in the war on this nebulous idea of terrorism and the grave threat posed to the world by Al-Qaeda, you know. Saudi Arabia practices a strict form of Islamic Sharia law. Under the law, a man can divorce his wife by saying, "I divorce you," three times. That's all he's got to do. "I divorce you. No soup for you." Three times. And what, he's like, click his heels together, and they write him a divorce papers or a certificate of divorce. "I divorce you three times." Yeah. Now, it's an interesting, this Saudi man was in Iraq, according to the newspaper at the Arab News. The Saudi man was in Iraq to participate in, quote, what he described as jihad. So, he's in Iraq to participate in what he described as, "Oh, I'm here for jihad." So, the guy's over there planting bombs. And maybe it's better that he went ahead and divorced his wife now, because if he is in Iraq participating in jihad, hopefully, it won't be long before a United States Marine or some other member of the United States military blasts him out of his filthy shoes. And his wife won't really have to worry about it. All right. So, Dateline Moscow, a Russian karate expert has been charged with beating to death a 63-year-old woman and her son, whom he accused of infecting his wife with lice. Yeah, the drunken 26-year-old Russian karate expert burst into a neighboring room at his hostel Tuesday and used karate moves to kill the pair. Yeah. A Russian investigator says, quote, he literally beat them to death with his hands and feet. Now, the family were poor and they drank a lot. And he blamed them for infecting his wife and the entire corridor with lice. The suspect, who studied karate for 7 years, faces life in prison if convicted. And I saw that and I thought, wait a minute, this is Russia. Do they not have the death penalty in Russia anymore? What's up with that? I mean, I know you get death for writing a negative op-ed about Vladimir Putin, but I don't think those death sentences are really, official. Well, I did the research and I found out that the Association of the Assembly of the Council of Europe has asked Russia to abolish the death penalty. That's right. And I found out, to my dismay, that that Russia has had a moratorium on the death penalty since 1996, after it joined the Council of Europe. Can you believe that? That's really bizarre. All right. Final update. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is not dead yet. That's right. How do we know that? Not by the way she looks, but because she gave an interview this week. She said it's lonely that she's the only woman in the Supreme Court. She said she wants to match the tenure of Justice Louis Brandeis, who served for more than two decades until he was 82 years old. And let's see. I did have something more from Ginsburg. In a videotaped tribute, she was given a speech, by the way, in Columbus, Ohio. And there was a videotape tribute to her put together by Chief Justice John Roberts, right? He's the conservative, right, that was appointed by George W. Bush. Well, he put together a videotape tribute where he praised Ginsburg's work habits, including her total disregard for the normal day-night work schedule adhered to by everyone else since the beginning of recorded history, and he congratulated her for reaching what he said was the midpoint of her career on the court. So we've got John Roberts rolling out a videotape tribute to Ruth Bader Ginsburg in a scene eerily reminiscent of Kim Jong-il's appearance before North Korea's parliament and the aforementioned standing ovation given to him and to John McCain by all the brain-dead people who are taking Western civilization right into the garbage can. Well, folks, I'll be back to document it all again for you and to comment upon it next week. And until then, I want to thank my friends at KGov, at Theology Online, at Personhood USA, and at American Right to Life. I want to thank all of you for being in the audience. I want to thank my other brother, Daryl. for making it all happen at the Weekly Worldview Studios. And I will be back with you next week. Until then, may the grace of our Lord be upon you, and may his peace be with you. Join me again next week.